accession number 19060, reel 6.
Jim Murray, reel 6.
Yeah, it was near towards the end of 64, the beginning of 65. Major Arnott, he got the military cross, the last military cross the battalion ever had. It's disbanded now, so he got the last one.
Because of that ambush?
It was so well executed, yeah.
And how long were you in Borneo for?
A year. Full year.
Any other incidents happened to you there?
Yes, we used to do river patrols on these long native boats and with outboard engines. And the only thing is, we used to have to carry lots of spares because the old propeller used to get caught up in all sorts of things, and we used to have to carry lots of bits for the repairing. And this particular day, we were pretty well, probably a few miles from the mouth of the river. And we never knew anything about this, but a fella came running up from the side of the river shouting, "Boar, boar." And we didn't know whether he was shouting whether it's a wild boar or what it was, or whether it was a Malayan word that we didn't know. But we soon did, because as we turned this bend, there's a wall of water coming at us, a 4 or 5 foot high, and it was like the seven boar. And the thing is, as we were taught in our training, hit it head on. Don't go that way. Hit it head on. And two of us did, and two of us didn't. And the ones that tried to make it to the bank tipped over. Luckily, all our rifles were tied to the gunwales of the boat with the rifle slings. So we never lost any weapons or any people either. But and the other thing was, the Dale I loved chips. Most sorts of loved, and you, them days you couldn't get chips because they all had Dixies which were too deep, and they couldn't get enough for a platoon or a company. It was you'd be on ages frying them. And this Irishman, he lives in Chelmsford now. I've got a friend in the village who's a friend of him. And he says to me, "Can you think of any way I could get some chips for the lads and cook them, you know?" I says, "Well, I know just the thing." I says, "A 40-gallon drum." I says, "If you take 8 inches off the top of a 40-gallon drum, you've got a lovely chip pan there." I says, we'll take it down to the river and we'll put the washy-washy girls sanding it out all day. They spend the whole day washing it with sand and that and water and get it nice and clean. And I says, then we just turn the drum up the other way, and now you've got a cooker. You just cut a hole in it and put the number one burner into the hole in the bin and put your lard into your pan, and you've got a chip pan." God, he said, "Try that." So we did it all, and there was enough chips for a whole platoon in that one in that one 40-gallon drum. But the thing was, we were like rationed, so all our grub had to come in by airdrop. And so we used to go down to the village square where there's a bit of a football field there and send a flare up, and the old Argosies used to come in and drop all our parachutes of grub down. Well, the colour sergeant, he'd say, "Oh, sorry about that one, mate, it's gone into the swamp." There was three things that used to go in the swamp that had to be replaced. Never did go in the swamp, like, but it was beer, meat and potatoes. And it was replaced without question. I mean, it was an emergency. Say, "Oh, there goes the meat." So a resupply of meat or a resupply of beer or whatever. And it was resupplied without question. So the Geordies always had plenty of chips there when they came off patrol. And extras if they wanted it, you know. But we were only allowed 2 beers a day, mind. We were never allowed more than 2 beers a day. But that was good, that. And we had an aerial ropeway that went from the village, across the river, up to our position on the hill. And we had a Land Rover choppered in there, which we used to hook onto the aerial ropeway. and fill the net full of all the goodies that had been dropped, and then the Land Rover would just drive away and haul this net up to the top of the hill, where there was a party there who would unload it all, and then it had to be pulled back down again for another load. Yeah, it was really good living there. It was a nice place. Yeah. But there was, besides the leeches, mosquitoes, snakes, it was quite nice.
What did you learn about the enemy?
Why, the enemy, this particular enemy that we contacted were not mercenaries and they were not irregulars. That information was wrong. They were top-notch Indonesian troops, and they had stale grey helmets on, starched olive green jackets with high leg brown boots and Kalashnikov automatic rifles, all carried at the high port. All tall men, all with big droopy mustaches. Top-notch, really smart-looking men. So they weren't irregulars, they weren't mercenaries. So that was a bit of a shock as well. Thinking you're going to hit some coolies, and suddenly they're there, similar to yourself, sort of thing, you know. Mind as I say, we never used to wash when we were out because of leptospirosis. We didn't. It was caused by rats' urine, and so the least little cut you had, that's used to get in. I don't think we had about 3 cases of it. So we never used to wash. So we were quite stinking when we come in. Our clothes were literally dropping off us.
You were frightened of getting the disease from water?
From the water. All our water had to be purified. The one way you could get clear water, if you come across a nice thick vine, about 2 inches diameter, cut yourself about 4 foot of that vine, and there's enough there to fill a water bottle. And that water would be pure. You could drink that. But otherwise, you had to put your sterilizing tablets and all that in, you know. And we only ate a warm meal at night time, just before dark, if we were out. And that was usually oxtail soup or something like that, cooked up on your hexaman burner.
And this ambush you've described was by the DLI, not by the Gurkhas?
No, this was the DLI. But while I was at Bukitnuggal, the DLI did the same thing, but instead of ambushing like we did, they formed single line and they went through the village and shot everything up. As people were jumping out of bed and all this, they just went through an extended line and they reckon they took 40, they killed 40.
40 Indonesians?
40 Indonesians. And they came back, and by the time we got back from our position, they'd drunk all the beer. They drunk all the rum, and all that was left in the nappy was a few bottles of whiskey.
Who was this? Who?
The Gurkhas. Because they'd had a successful clash, they allowed them to have a knees up, you know. Yeah, so when we got back, there was no beer and no rum, just a bottle of whiskey which we shared.
Anything else we ought to say about Burma?
Borneo.
About Borneo, rather.
Yeah, I think that's about it now. There's lots of little things, but there's nothing of great interest then. We came from Borneo to Singapore, to the transit camp at Singapore. And we were there a few days prior to flying home. And we came to Colchester, Miani Barracks at Colchester. And I was then transferred back to the reconnaissance platoon. I was there, became their sergeant once more, and I'd been promised a job in the northeast, my hometown, with the 15 Army Youth Team. But I'd never heard any, I'd been promised that in Borneo, but nothing else had occurred, so just carried on at Colchester. And I was battalion orderly sergeant one night, and it was a dinner night, sergeant's mess dinner night. So although I was battalion orderly sergeant, I was still allowed to have a beer and a meal. And then I was called out to down the Mersey Road, which is 10 minutes from the camp, where there was a disturbance there again, the fish shop. Being battalion orderly sergeant, I had to go and investigate and make sure our men were brought in without causing any trouble. So I went down there, solved that problem, then I saw a disturbance further down, and it was a military policeman who was involved, and he was trying to arrest two of my men who were just, let's say, 5 foot six, 5 foot eight, but they were giving him, he was rubbing them up the wrong way. And I said, look, my instructions are to get my men in as off the streets, and he says, it's my job to arrest these. I said, well, and I was a bit hot-headed in them days, and I elbowed the RMP, and not hard, but I elbowed him, and I made sure it was me that was putting these in the nick. Anyhow, he followed us up there, and he watched me put them in the nick, empty the pockets and all that, and put them in the guard room. And then he says, can I have your ID card? And I said, yes, of course you can. And can I have the... And he took all the particulars down. And within half an hour, like, the garrison... The marshal, what do you call him? The provost marshal was on the phone. And the outcome of it was the colonel, who I got on great with, and he was my... You know, I couldn't say anything wrong again. He says, look, I've got to deal with you. He says... So I was charged, but admonished, but on the grounds that I got a posting to the north, which I was wanting anyhow, you see. But that was his way of putting it, the major's way of putting it, the colonel's way of putting it.
Well, could I just ask you a general question about relationships between soldiers and civilians in Colchester? What have they been like in your experience?
They've been good. It's a good garrison town, and there's a thing on the telly lately. I don't know if you've seen it, about the program about the troops and the females in Colchester, and it's a real put down, really. It's showing the women off as there's all loose women, like, you know, and the men, how they enjoy Colchester and all that. But in general, we always fared well. There was always fights, there was always squatty pubs, and there was always civilian pubs, and there was fights, but in general, the town then seemed to depend on the troops being there, the businesses and the taxis and all everything else, you know.
So you mean this TV programme is an inaccurate representation of the truth?
Absolutely, I think so. I think it is.
They make it out to be worse than it
is? Worse than it is, yeah, I think so.
No, I think you did active service in Northern Ireland.
Yes, when I was with the Army Youth Team, the battalion disbanded, the Durham's disbanded, and I was asked to stay with the Army Team an extra year. So that was disbanded in 68, and I stayed up the north till 69th, when I transferred to the Military Provost Staff Corps, which is the glasshouse to squaddies, the prison, the Army prison.
So you were in the Royal Military Police Corps?
It's like the sister regiment to the military police. And I did a course, a 3 month course there on security and all that, and how the running of the various wings and that. And believe it or not, but the bloke that I'd nudged was on the same course. He transferred from the military police onto the Military Provost Staff Corps. And we became quite good pals. And when I passed out of the course, I actually went to D Wing, which is the discharge wing. Anybody that's done any real serious cases, drugs or things, they went to the discharge wing. So I went there.
What's it called? The military police?
Military Provo.
Military Provo
Staff Corps.
So you were for duties in army prisons?
Yes, that's right. There was only the one. There's only the one prison.
In Colchester?
In the country.
Is it in Colchester?
Yes, yeah.
And did you go to that prison?
I went. I did my training at the prison there. Well, they don't call it the corrective centre. The corrective training centre, they call it. And I did my training there, and started work in the detention wing. And
What is the detention wing?
Well, people who have been discharged, D-Wing, which the discharge wing, I should say, not detention, discharge wing. So they do the time, and then they're sent out into Civvy Street, they finish with the army. Where A and B wings, they did the sentence, and then they went back to the units.
What were you taught should be the policy towards these malefactors?
Well, I'm interested. Their punishment was in being in there, you know. But they were bawled at, they were shouted at, they were on the go from morning till night. But you still had to treat them fairly. Had to be treated fairly. And usually these lads going back to the units were made up to Lance Corporals in a few weeks because their equipment was spot on. We'd retrained them. They'd been the foot drill, the arms training, everything. The physical fitness. They were so fit when they went back to the units. They were 10 times better than the actual men that they had there. So they used to promote them. They were so good.
And when were you working at the correction centre then?
From 69 to 79.
10 years?
Yeah, the last 10 years. 10 years.
So how is it you came to go to Northern Ireland if you were in the military police?
Yeah, we had to go to the Mays. We helped to run the Mays prison. And also we had a hospital ward, a fortified hospital ward there, down at Musgrave Hospital, where the wounded terrorists were kept. I ran that for a while.
Where's the Musgrave Hospital?
Down in Belfast. And as I say, we were at the Mays, and we used to do searches there. All the visitors coming in, we used to have to search them. We had women searches there for the females. They just spit on you and all blue and sorts. But after the first visit to Northern Ireland, I came out of the discharge wing, D wing, and I took over the pig farm. The only pig breeding farm in the British Army.
Is this in Colchester?
Yeah.
Before we go back to Colchester, if we can just finish with Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. What were conditions like in the Mays?
Well, they were bad. The first time I went there, they were bad because there was the old smear in the walls with excretia, you know. It was in a terrible state, and they're just sitting around with blankets on, and the men were having to go in with steamers and steam the walls clean and all that sort of thing. We didn't have to do anything of that kind. But at night time, as a staff sergeant, I'd be the only soldier in there. But it was the idea being that there was loyalist warders and there was Catholic warders, and there was Catholic prisoners and there was loyalist prisoners. And they always put an army representative in there to make sure that everybody was being fair and even, sort of thing. And I didn't like that either. You felt so isolated in there, only squatty in there among all those. But there weren't just Irishmen, mind. You had warders from Durham Jail and various other cities, you know, that were getting extra money. They liked being there because they got extra danger money, sort of thing. Well, the army never got anything like that.
And did this system, you mean that Catholic warders dealt with Catholics Protestant warders dealt with Protestants?
At the time, no, it was quite a mixed, sort of routine, you know. They weren't segregated then, it was all mixed up.
And was there much trouble amongst the prisoners?
There was kangaroo courts and all that happening at the time, you know. People were getting hurt and one thing and another.
And did you have to deal with that?
Yeah, well, not so much as the warders dealt with most of this.
So
we were more or less there for searching, as they were we were at the gatepost, searching visitors coming in, searching people going out. A friend of mine, he was on one day. And the priest came in and handed his credentials over. And when he got in there, one of the IRA got the priest, took his garb off him and put it on and came out. And this friend of ours went and handed the credentials over to the IRM, and off he went. He got out. Poor old priest was in the cell.
Was the priest a willing accomplice to it, or?
Probably was, but we couldn't prove it, you know. And they'd come in with, an old boy used to come in with the raggiest, greasiest clothes you could ever think of, and you had to search him. And then in his trouser pocket, in his greasy trouser pocket, would be a wad of notes so thick yet you couldn't get it out. So eventually he got it out. Well, you then had to count all them notes because he wanted them notes back when he went out. So you had to make sure they were all there and you count them in front of him. All this was like ticking the mick sort of thing, you know. And then another case was...
What do you mean taking the mick?
Well, wasting time. If we hadn't discovered that money, it would have been gone to the people in there. But because we had discovered it, I'd get our hands all greasy, going into his pockets and all that, and have to count. I'm talking about a couple of £1,000 or something like that. In fivers, like, you know. Having to count all that, and everybody else waiting to be searched as well, sort of thing. And this is the way they used to do it. And another time I was standing there outside, and I looked at the frosted window and I could see a woman with a clothes up. She had a blue coat on, but I could see her underclothes. She was bending down. I don't know, right at the window. And it wasn't the toilet. I thought, well, she's not at the toilet. So I recognised she had a purple coat on. So I called one of the women searchers out. I said, you want to search that woman more closely, especially around the waist area. I said, I've just seen her doing something there. So there was a strike on at the time. They weren't eating, a hunger strike. And this woman had packets of dried peas and that up a vagina, wedged up a vagina, which she was hoping to get in. So they weren't on hunger strike. You know? Wouldn't have fancied that, mind. But that's what they used to do. They used to actually spit at you, spit right in your face for nothing at all, just for being a soldier.
Which side? Was it just one side who did this?
These were the Catholic women, IRA women, you know.
And how did the visitors to the Protestant side behave?
They were quite good. They were quite good. They were, as I say, the loyalists, don't they? They regard themselves as loyalists. They regarded themselves as an army, really. Just forces.
Did you discover anything in these searches?
No, as I say, there was various things. There was various things found, but nothing of any great significance that I was there anyhow. No.
And what about this work at Musgrave Hospital, guarding the wounded?
Yeah, that was it. We had a couple of regular nurses there that were on nights with us. And we worked days and nights, man. We had closed circuit television, so people never got in unless we could identify them. And the wounded prisoners were dealt with by the nurses, they used to verbally abuse the nurses, some terrible mind. Amazing, and yet you couldn't do anything to stop it. You had to stand there and listen to it. And if any of them needed surgery, you had to take them up there. So you ended up with a wounded man on a stretcher, and you'd have a fella in front of you with a 9mm automatic pistol, and a one behind you and two nurses pushing the thing, and you were there with all your bits and pieces of paper. And you'd take them up to surgery, and then one of you had to go in, usually it was me, and you'd put your white hat on and your white things over your shoes, you know, and you had to go in there to watch that the surgery was up and above board, because there was Catholic surgeons and there was Protestant surgeons, and so you had to go in to ensure that everything was dealt with properly. At least what you saw, what you thought. I mean, they could have done something that you... But in actual fact, you had to be there to see that nothing was happening untoward.
Did anything untoward happen to you, in your opinion?
No, not that I saw. No, not that I saw. But they used to say, well, it's swings and roundabouts. If the Catholics, if the Catholic surgeons did them, did that to the Protestant surgeons would get the wrong, which is not a very nice thing. But nothing really occurred that I saw.
Did you feel yourself in any danger when you were in Northern Ireland?
Sometimes in the cars, we used to change our cars every week because they soon twigged onto us as to who you were, like, you know. In fact, that's, if you remember the incident where that car bumped into a funeral procession and how they were, well, that could have happened to anyone. They weren't spies or anything like that. They were just doing a job. They'd been doing a job somewhere. They were, I think they were signal, Royal Signals. They'd been doing a job, doing wiring job somewhere. And this is what used to happen. You used to get routes to follow. They used to give you routes to follow. Because if you follow the same route all the time, you're liable to ambush. So they used to say, right, you will use this route and that route. And we used to get the same. And that was the only time I used to feel vulnerable, was travelling to and from. But as I say, luckily we were okay.
Do you know which years you were in Northern Ireland?
Well, the first time was 72, which was a rough year. But as I say, nothing compared to what the people on the streets, you know, the paras and that had on the streets. We were just in defended places, which was different kettle of fish. And we had the injured, or the, at least they were prisoners, you know. Not like the fellas on patrol in the streets.
So where did you live, in Belfast?
No, we lived in the Mays. When I first there, the sergeant's mess in the Mays was so full, I was in a caravan. I slept in a caravan. Yeah. And it's like the prison officers had a camp, which they all lived in. There's one or few local people that lived out, but most of the Brits lived in this camp. And it was a corrugated sheeted camp, painted, they used to call it Silver City because it was painted silver. And then the helicopter people, they had their own little place where they used to live, and they had a bar. So you could have a good night out having a trip to Silver City and having a few beers there, and popping down to the helicopter place and having a couple of beers there on your night off. Or they could come to the sergeant's mess where we were and have a couple of beers there. That was our existence. Some people used to go out, but I never took a chance of drinking outside.
How did you like serving in Northern Ireland?
Oh, I didn't mind it. I didn't mind. I went. The last time was only 3 months before I retired. I didn't have to go, but I had a friend who was, because I was running the pig farm then, and I was training this other fella into the pig farm, and he was an Irishman. He was a Protestant, and he was said he didn't want to go back to Ireland because his dad had said there's a bullet waiting for him. And I went in, I says, well, I'll go. I says, I know which is the easier job. It's much easier in Northern Ireland than looking after 200 blooming pigs here every day, 24 hours a day. I says, I'll do that if you like. I says, can you manage the pigs? Oh, I could manage the pigs, he said. So I went and saw the RSM. He says, you must be daft. 3 months to do and going out to Ireland. I said, I don't mind, I'll do it. And I did the 3 month tour.
That must have been in 79 then?
That was 79, yeah.
How many sessions did you do in Northern?
Just the two in the 10 years.
72 and 79.
But if I hadn't wanted to, I would have only done the one, you know, the one in 72, but I volunteered for that last one. I didn't need to, I'd been at the pig farm.